This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's not just political terms that are blocked. It's other terms as well. For example, the term one-night stand has been blocked on Weibo.
When we think of censorship in the Chinese media, we obviously think of scandals and stories about corruption, political overthrows, religious cults. But it might be surprising to some folks that other key topics that are broad topics that are blocked on Weibo include things about, sex, drugs, not rock and roll, but other sorts of prurient interests. And one night stand falls under the attempts to prevent spiritual pollution.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast Show. We're joined today by Jason Ng, a research fellow at the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab and author, most recently, of Blocked on Weibo. Jason, China has 1.2 billion people and 600 million active internet users. And my understanding is that a pretty big chunk of those 600 million are interacting with Sino-Weibo. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, Weibo is probably the most important social media website in China at the moment. It started in August 2009, but it didn't really find its feet, at least in the way that we think of it, until like the summer of 2011, when there was this horrific train crash, this high-speed train crash in Wenzhou. And the speed and the activity, how quickly people took to Weibo to start to pillory the officials who were in charge of the cleanup, in charge of the oversight of the train crash. It was just stunning to watch this supposedly repressed society come out and have this sort of active discussion. It was just fascinating to watch. And it was from there that we started to see the rise of Weibo truly in the following year, and the way that it brought down local officials, and the way that it started various sorts of protests in different cities across the country against chemical factories, against corruption. And today, it's probably the place to go to if you want to catch the pulse of the Chinese internet population.
So when you're talking about 600 million internet users in China, how many of them are using the big Weibo platforms?
Yeah, I think last check, it was roughly 300 or 400 million registered accounts. Unfortunately, registered accounts doesn't necessarily equate active users. So our last check, it was between 50 to 100 million daily active users, which sounds like a lot. But when you think about it, Facebook, I think, is up to 700 million active users. But so it's dwarfed.
But that's on a user base in the neighborhood of 4 billion, something like that, right?
Quite, exactly. Quite
that's
well, exactly.
That's an exaggeration. But so, that's a good chunk. And also, there are many people who are presumably passive users of the service. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And especially not just folks within China, but also these passive users are around the world. We have news outlets in the US, in the UK, and around the world who actively monitor Weibo as a way to get a sense of what's happening actually on the ground in different places in China. Certainly, Weibo isn't a perfect analog for the population itself. It's skewed towards younger users, skewed toward more educated users. But certainly, it's better than, say, watching the CCTV, which is the state television's evening news, to get a sense of what's actually happening in the country. It's, for the most part, more unfiltered than other sorts of media in China.
And it also facilitates the diffusion of ideas. So, you have an idea emerging in one Chinese city, and then it's a platform, even with passive users, just observing the trends in another city as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a national thing. It's Not some, you know, specifically Beijing or Shanghai, but certainly it's certainly more concentrated in affluent urban areas. But this is, for the most part, a national place of dialogue. And I think that truly makes it one of the unique social media websites in countries that have restricted internet. For the most part, places like Iran don't have this sort of vast national level venue for people to speak and share information.
It's interesting the fact that they allow something like this to flourish, you know, given the potential it might have to kind of sow dissent. But one thing I wonder about is that when you're looking at the dominant social networks, they have globalized very rapidly. So, for example, if you look at Facebook, you know, Facebook had many formidable competitors in many other countries that it eventually displaced. So, you know, if you Brazil, Germany, many places had Facebook clones, social networks that served many similar purposes, yet, you know, that didn't actually survive that competition over time. Twitter, you know, launched, I believe it was 2006. This service launches in 2009, yet Sina Weibo remains the dominant platform. So tell us a little bit about that, the fact that these kind of dominant U.S. social networks have not been able to make inroads into China. I imagine it's a very deliberate policy choice.
Yeah, deliberate policy choice on both ends. For the most part, yeah, as you mentioned, Chinese or U.S. companies have certainly saw the Chinese market as this potential gold mine of users and revenue. But unfortunately, they haven't been able to crack it, or both for their personal reason, for their own reasons, but also because the Chinese government in many ways has enacted barriers on entry. So Twitter actually was usable in China before roughly 2009, 2010. But unfortunately, due to various political events within the country, the Chinese government actually added Twitter to the Great Firewall, the list of websites that users within China, within mainland China, can't actually access. So these are foreign websites like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. And this is not only for controlling of content. Certainly they don't want these outside companies to be reachable to users and have them find the latest information about how to take down the government or how to start a revolution in the country, but also for economic reasons.
So there's also a protectionist dimension.
Yeah.
They want to cultivate indigenous companies rather than just allow foreign companies that are already dominant to kind of come into their sandbox.
Exactly. And it's, for two reasons. Not only to support the growth of these local companies like Sina and Tencent for economic purposes to make them these global economic superpowers, but also because these local companies are easier to control. If they're locally based, what you can do is compel them to comply with local laws. You can actually take down their servers. You could threaten managers or executives with potential punishments, fines. So in many ways, having a local analog for these services that would normally be able to enter into foreign markets allows the Chinese government to basically control the flow of information in a much easier fashion.
And in fairness to the Chinese government, it certainly is true that when you're looking at U.S.-based multinationals, there seems to be a reasonable amount of evidence that the U.S. government has a fair bit of leverage over those business enterprises. And so, you know, if I were a Chinese official, not even necessarily a paranoid Chinese official, I might think by giving access to these U.S.-based multinationals, I am perhaps indirectly giving backdoor access to the U.S. government as well.
Yeah, that's again a security issue that we've seen not just in China but all around the world, especially in light of the Snowden revelations. So you see Brazil threatening various tech companies in the U.S. saying, look, we can't have potential siphoning off of information, so you must store the data within our own country so we could protect it. So China, in many ways, the Snowden revelations have given China a lot of ammunition to sort of give cover to a lot of the things that they're doing already. And it's very interesting to see how that'll play out.
Let's talk a bit more about the Great Firewall, a term that you hear pretty often. So when you think about the internet and the origins of the internet, the idea is, kind of this big decentralized, or the web specifically, big decentralized peer-to-peer system that was supposed to be extremely difficult to control. I mean, part of the idea was that, this was going to be a very robust, very resilient, means of communicating information from one place to another. And yet it seems as though the Great Firewall has actually worked remarkably well. So tell me a bit about it and about its origins. Was the Great Firewall something that, you know, began when the internet started achieving mass penetration in China? But you know, tell us a bit about its origins.
Yeah, the Great Firewall is this sort of general term for how China controls flow of information from outside of its country into mainland China. Of course, this isn't unique to China. Every country forms some sort of has internet regulations on the books that controls, you know, what sort of information is perhaps illegal within the country. What is interesting is that China's
so the U.S. will try to control, for example, internet gambling, mm-hmm. or you know, perhaps the Pirate Bay,
right.
or kind of various other.
Exactly. But what's particularly interesting about China is that they've enacted all sorts of technical barriers for a lot of these things, not only using legal avenues to try and take down. Potentially serve notice to different sites about illegal content that might be on there, but also to strictly prevent people from within the country to access information. So providing these technical barriers, and which many other countries would consider, would deem it safe and acceptable. So that's the rub. Where do we draw this line between what's acceptable and unacceptable? And clearly, apparently the Chinese have drawn it perhaps far too much on one side. But yeah, so they have these technical barriers. What we mentioned, so folks within mainland China can't access Google, Facebook, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. But what's more perhaps pervasive is this internal censorship, the so-called golden shield. So again, that's what we talked about. The internal companies within China are compelled to comply with local laws, and from there, that's where most of the information control takes place.
So these are discrete concepts. The Great Firewall is one concept, kind of about blocking information from the outside, or kind of guaranteeing that the information that comes from the outside is, you know, kind of carefully controlled. And the golden shield is this kind of richer set of controls that. Tell me about, this must be very labor intensive. Is that fair to say? I mean, are there a lot of bodies? Are there a lot of officials? I imagine also we don't know very much about it, but tell me a little bit about what we do know.
Yeah, my dream is to basically find just carry a bag of money and go into China and find a censor and basically have them do a tell-all book. But barring that, what we can do is perform various sorts of monitoring and testing. So the lab I'm at, the Citizen Lab, and various other places do this sort of thing to see basically how many censors, how many people, how many bodies do you need to actually do this sort of censorship that we're seeing. So there was a great research paper put out by folks from, I believe, University of Texas, but it was called the Velocity of Censorship. And it's fascinating where they make assumptions based on what they've seen, how many censors are actually performing this sort of filtering on sites like Weibo. And their guess was somewhere between maybe 1,000, maybe less than that. And actually, there's Reuters article just came out a couple of months ago wherein they actually talk to and interview these censors who are in Tianjin, which is a city just outside Beijing. And essentially what they came up with was there are several hundred people in this one single office that are doing the entire censorship for the entire country. Just on my personal level, that seems a little low, but the reporting seems pretty accurate, and the description of the office is just really scary to think that there are basically a few hundred folks who are, with the assistance of computer algorithms, basically controlling the flow of information on this entire social media website, which is just truly a massive sprawling place.
That actually brings me, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but you talk, so your book, in it you're identifying various terms that have been blocked on Weibo, and basically explaining why, offering theories as to why they might have been blocked. And one of them brings to mind the idea of this personnel question. So it seems that, you know, because there's such a huge volume of things that might prove problematic that to some extent you'd want to crowdsource this. So there's a term referring to the 50 Cent gang, is that right? Tell us a little bit about these people.
Right, it's the 50 Cent Party, which is sort of like a jokey reference to the Communist Party. So like, this is a separate party that's sprung up to actually help the Communist Party in filtering and cleaning up the internet.
And is this something we know about for sure? Is this just kind of a rumor? Is this something the government has acknowledged really does exist?
The government acknowledges that it's an important aspect of the pieces of regulations that help them clean up the internet, certainly. So It's less clear actually whether or not they actually receive 50 cent each. That's the purported amount of money that each member receives for posting a positive comment about China or a critical comment about folks who are against China. I don't know if people, I don't know if how much money the government's mailing out 50 cents at a time, but they actually do have people on staff who are like these analysts who basically monitor social media. And whether or not they're employed in a, officially by the government or whether they're contracted, certainly these positions have been publicly acknowledged in state papers. There was a recent article in the Global Times which mentioned how they are now like an official body, and or not an official body, but they've served in capacities which clearly are propaganda purposes. And but I think it's more interesting that rather than simply like identify a specific organization or a specific department in, that's doing this, what they've done, the government, in some ways, has actually crowdsourced it to not just a single party, but to basically all citizens, because most citizens in China, for the most part, are very proud to be Chinese. They, despite all the immense corruption and despite the growing inequality, folks are proud to be Chinese, and you see this in national surveys and whatnot. And oftentimes, if they see comments that are against the government or against the country, they'll come in and jump in and post positive comments regardless of whether or not they're paid by the government. That's just what they believe. That's just what
so in
feel.
A way, the 50 cent party term is something that's kind of a catch-all that people can use to discredit, you know, right. kind of a larger group of people, some of whom might actively be working for the government, but many others are people who just are kind of happy to kind of tamp down this kind of criticism.
Right.
So in a way, when you're talking about the censorship, it has to be, it's actually not that crude. Sometimes it can be about channeling opinion in one direction rather than another and intervening in a kind of not so heavy-handed way, but to kind of bend the conversation in one direction rather than another. Is that a fair
characterization? Yeah, absolutely. The perception of censorship in repressive places, relative to perhaps the U.S., is that this is very heavy-handed. It's the government top-down, laying the smack down, issuing orders and decrees. And to some extent, there are these sorts of things. China Digital Times, which is this website which tracks censorship in China and various other things, they actually received these leaked documents, which they call directives from the Ministry of Truth, and they actually are these sort of weekly decrees from the government saying, all right, this is to media organizations with the country saying, all right, this is how we're going to treat this topic this week. But for the most part, certainly it's much more nuanced than that. And I think the complexity of it hopefully is shown through in my book. And
so one thing I wonder about is that when you're looking at Chinese media traditionally, my understanding is that the censorship even then was decentralized. So, what would happen is that if I want to start a magazine, I have to acquire a license. And this license could be from the, Anhui Province Cultural Workers Committee, something like that. And then they give me their certification. Maybe I purchase it from them, something like that. And so in a way, they serve as a kind of quasi-censor because they don't want you to embarrass them so that someone there has to answer to somebody else. Whereas when you're talking about 600 million internet users, it certainly sounds as though the Chinese government decided, we can't give up on this economic opportunity. It's too big. The decentralized nature of this network is part of what makes it a great generative platform for entrepreneurs and others. So we can't work this the way that we did print publications or whatever else. We need to allow for some level of danger, potentially. We just need... So it sounds like that was actually a pretty sophisticated decision. They were like, we can't control this completely. Is that a fair characterization of their attitude,
right,
as you understand it?
Yeah. And if you look at it, these actual companies that are actually serving up the services, so Sina or Tencent or whatever, they have an incentive to actually promote this sort of dangerous speech that we would think of for the government, because
it's viral.
You want people to come back, you want eyeballs, you want people to start discussing, and so they have that angle that they have to try and service. They want certainly their users are their customers. But in many ways, their other customer is the government, because the government can certainly step in at any time and say, hey, you've gone too far. This is the end of it. We're no longer allowing you to continue.
It also seems that China, Xi Jinping, the kind of new paramount leader, who seems to be consolidating his authority in all kinds of ways, has in the past talked about the internet and the use of the internet as a tool that might be able to contain corruption. So it seems that, there's some recognition on the part of the government, too, that this can be used to, for more constructive purposes this as well to kind of maybe contain public discontent?
That's correct. Corruption has been one of the key platforms in Xi's new administration, and in many respects, it's brought down numerous folks, and the most recent one, Zhou Yongkang, who is now under house arrest, and he was a close ally of Bo Xilai, the former head of Chongqing. So it's paying dividends, certainly, this anti-corruption platform and folks, you know, assisting bringing down local officials. And however, the last couple of months have been quite dispiriting for folks who view the internet as corruption platform as a way to give free speech activists an opening via the internet, because they've actually targeted some of these anti-corruption activists. And whereas in the past they would encourage these anti-corruption activists on the internet, they've been starting to crack down. There was a guy who, his big thing was posting pictures of officials wearing luxury wristwatches. And it was fascinating because obviously, you know, this local
right. How did you afford that watch?
Right. So in many ways, that was the perfect example of what Xi Jinping wanted to support. But all of a sudden, now he was arrested.
Just a bit more about that example specifically, because it seems like a really good case. So my understanding, my recollection is that there was someone who died in a kind of vehicular homicide. And then there was a traffic enforcement officer who was just very brusque and not very helpful. And it turns out that he was wearing a very expensive watch. Is that roughly what
exactly
had happened?
Yeah, that's exactly the one. Yeah, he's known as Smiling Brother or Brother Watch. Yeah, that's what.
And so was that later censored? Was that something, or was that something that was allowed to propagate and spread?
That's very interesting. See, this is among the push and pulls of these private internet companies. They're not sure where exactly to draw the line, certainly, and it's not a bug that the government doesn't tell these private companies exactly what to do. It's a feature because by not specifically laying out exactly, you know, what is disruptive to the social order, which is one of the tenets that these local private companies have to abide by. What they do is force private companies to make decisions to say, all right, where do we draw the line? What does the government want? We're not sure, so we're going to over-censor.
If the government said, here are 100 terms, you'd better not allow these to be seen anywhere, you'd better not allow these terms to be published, then it would be trivial. It would be extremely easy for the companies. And then, of course, people being creative and innovative in various ways would come up with other terms they could use that kind of, use Cyrillic script or kind of whatever else. Whereas by not telling you, by giving you this vague mandate, you have to figure it out yourself to keep those guys happy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And with the example of the anti-corruption stuff, what you'll find is that these private companies are constantly forced to waver and basically see how things play out. And sometimes the government will then step in, either whether it's the national government, more oftentimes maybe more lower level wrongs, maybe the provincial or local officials who will basically, you know, bug Weibo and say, hey, we got to tamp down on this, otherwise it'll cause a furor.
So one way of thinking about it is that if I'm criticizing the corruption of a particular official and say, boy, you know, I'm glad that Xi Jinping and the Communist Party are out there to crack down on this kind of corruption, that's one thing. Whereas to say that this corruption is pervasive, bring down the Communist Party, I mean, those are two very different statements.
Right.
And the former might be something that is actually seen as a useful escape valve, whereas you want to prevent the former from becoming the latter.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to have the human element involved, these human censors who have these algorithms that try and figure out, basically flag messages, and then they go through and they actually go through them and delete messages individually if need be. However,
and you might do that after the fact, too. Yeah. The message has already been published, it's gone up,
right.
And then you get to it using this algorithm, someone used this tool, and then so 24 hours later they might delete
it. Right, although sometimes messages are stuck in queue and then you could actually delete them before they go in. But it's very interesting to see that there are different researchers who have different opinions on how they actually go about implementing this. So Gary King at Harvard has two great papers along with his associates about the different ways that how they see censorship taking place across the internet. And their theory is that for the most part you could criticize the Chinese government, but anything that touches on basically creating collective action, street protests, demonstrations, organizing, that's where they actually do the most of the clamping down. I think other folks are a little more, who are not quite sure exactly how much criticism is allowed, but certainly on Weibo, by looking at the censored keywords and by looking at the censored keywords in other different chat applications and other social media platforms, what we see is that criticism of the government is still very much controlled.
So your book is a compendium of terms that have at various points been blocked on Weibo. And you know, this is something that changes over time. New terms are added, et cetera. It seems like they're very flexible. But let's go through some of these terms. One of the terms is May 35th. And as you and I both know, May 35th is not, in fact, a real date. But so why would May 35th be blocked?
Yeah, we could just do some basic addition here. So May 31st, May 32nd would be June 1st. May 33rd would be June 2nd, so, and then you get to May 35th is June 4th, which, if you're not familiar, June 4, 1989 was this notorious day in Chinese history wherein tanks were ordered into Tiananmen Square to clear out these student demonstrators and other demonstrators who were basically trying to promote political reform within the Chinese Communist Party. And unfortunately, there was much bloodshed, and it has gone down as this day that the Chinese government has tried to scrub off the internet. So
June 4th is definitely going to be blocked, but May 35th was a clever way around that, and then they caught on.
Yeah, so this is the sort of thing. A lot of the keywords that I find that I uncover through this ways of deciphering them, it's interesting to see that a lot of them are really code words, and it's these are already internet activists and folks who have already thought of ways to get around the censorship, but the censors have caught up. So this is an example of basically how the censors are constantly on their guard to catch up and uncover different ways that people are trying to discuss sensitive topics.
It's interesting because it makes you think that the censors themselves are, in some cases, going to be pretty savvy people who are part of the same cultural networks and kind of understand. So some of the terms are quite peculiar, or certainly peculiar to American ears. For example, the term hairy bacon. What is hairy bacon?
It's certainly something you don't want to eat. Hairy bacon. So in Chinese, it's pronounced mao laro. And literally, mao means hair. Laro means jerky or sausage or preserved meat. So again, this is another coded keyword, because clearly, hairy bacon itself doesn't seem like a sensitive term until you decipher it. So mao is not just hair, but also a different sort of mao, a surname for Mao Zedong. And laro is not just meat that you eat, but also a different sort of preserved meat, his body, which is laid in state in a mausoleum outside Tiananmen Square.
Sounds incredibly disrespectful.
Yeah. I think that's probably what the censors thought too. What's particularly notable about this is that it's so mostly obscure. I noted that it was censored more than a year and a half ago. And when I tried looking it up, there was very few usages of it just in the general internet. However, I did, after much searching and, after discussing with native speakers about what it might mean, and they didn't quite know either, eventually I found a recipe for how to make mao laro, and that's how I uncovered it. But it's such an obscure word that it's curious that the censors, censored this despite the fact that it was so rarely used. And it's just sort of like a Streisand effect going on here, and that this is a word that's almost been given prominence because it's been censored. And the only way that I uncovered it was through the fact that it was being censored. So, and now it's a common meme now. I think China Digital Times just posted images of people, posting strips of bacon as a reference to mao laro.
And photographs are presumably harder to censor than text.
You would think so, but obviously the Chinese government has resources. They've been throwing it at the problem. And for a while, actually, people were...
But just the same way that Google is going to try to filter certain offensive images, similarly, there could be some algorithm that's able to detect certain patterns and shapes.
Right, yeah. So one of the earliest ways that people tried to get around the censors was to embed text, like Chinese characters, within images, envisioning that that would be harder for censors to actually uncover. But obviously, as technology has kept pace, the censors have figured this out, and there are different ways that they do
this. Why would the word Bloomberg be blocked?
Outside of the fact that very recently that the whole Bloomberg debacle, essentially about how Bloomberg spiked these stories about China and how that's a scandal. Despite this actually block took place well before that. It took place, I think, roughly 2 years ago, and I wasn't quite sure at the time why Bloomberg was being targeted, because many number of other media outlets, for the most part, were searchable on Sino Weibo, but that one wasn't. However, in the coming in the months after, it became more clear that Bloomberg has actually been doing quite a bit of enterprising China journalism, investigative journalism, including a story about Xi Jinping's family wealth. So that was one example of why they would want to block searches for Bloomberg. And now, of course, Bloomberg is a super hot topic. The website was blocked in China. And I believe that the journalists' visas are still being held up. That was Reuters and New York Times, sorry. But clearly, the control of foreign media is a major deal for Sina Weibo and the Chinese authorities.
The term Bo Xilai is blocked, and what I find interesting about that is that, you know, this is an enormously important story. And, you know, it seems like a very difficult... It seems very difficult to kind of try to contain discussion about this, but tell me a bit about the thinking around that.
Yeah, what's particularly interesting about Bo Xilai is that right now it's actually unblocked. So, you know, obviously it's still a sensitive term, so that gives clear evidence that...
And Bo Xilai was the party secretary of Chongqing, city of over 30 million in the heart of China, and he was seen as someone who was offering an alternative to the existing Chinese government and its ideology, and he became quite popular because of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, perhaps he got too popular, and his method of self-promotion, I guess, which is what the other party leaders claimed that he was doing, brought him down because essentially he was trying to, in some ways, work outside the party. But they technically got him on corruption and, you know, womanizing, and his wife was alleged and later convicted of murdering this British national. So he's clearly a sensitive topic. He's unblocked on Weibo right
his
now.
His son reportedly drives Ferraris.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised that most major politicians, you know, just children have quite expensive tastes. But yeah, he's unblocked right now. But if you actually search for him on Weibo, you won't see, you know, Bo Xilai messages that are too supportive of him. That sort of material is still being censored. But yeah, it's interesting because Bo Xilai, if you look at the history of his name, whether or not it was blocked, it goes through these fascinating periods where the government and or Weibo, we're not sure who's ordering, who's deciding what at this point. You could see that his name goes from unblocked to blocked at various key junctures of the scandals. And we just produced this infographic at the Citizen Lab that shows how these offline events are very much related to the censorship going on online. So for instance, he's blocked on Weibo for 2012, beginning of 2013, the scandal begins, he's unblocked for a brief period, but then he's reblocked, and then going on forth, it goes, flips back and forth.
It's almost as though there's a thermostat, and if it gets too hot, you block it, and if it cools down, then you unblock it.
Right.
That's fascinating. It's not just political terms that are blocked, it's other terms as well. For example, the term one-night stand has been blocked on Weibo. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so obviously we think of, when we think of censorship in the Chinese media, we obviously think of scandals and stories about corruption, political overthrows, religious cults. But it might be surprising to some folks that other key topics that are broad topics that are blocked on Weibo include things about, you know, sex, drugs, you know, not rock and roll, but other sorts of prurient interests. And certainly one night stand falls under the sex category. China's, in many ways...
Rock and roll is blocked sometimes, like the band Pangu.
Yeah, that's right, in the
blocked.
Book, exactly, because of their political overtures. It's very interesting to see how the Chinese government, like not just now, but over the course of the last several decades since the Cultural Revolution, have dealt with this sort of influence influences outside of China. So, you know, you have the sexual revolution going on out in the U.S. and other countries outside. How does China import market values that are so important for its economic growth without importing all these other values? So the tension between that and making sure that the population isn't spiritually polluted is very interesting. And one night stand falls under the attempts to prevent spiritual pollution.
And is that something that you see change over time? Do you feel as though the government has become more permissive about spiritual pollution, in some years than others, or has that been pretty consistent?
yeah, I guess if we're looking at the broader picture, certainly things are much more open now than they were maybe a decade or even or 2 decades or even a decade ago.
But I even mean in this little period of time the kind of microblogging services have become so popular.
Yeah, it's curious because right now One Night Stand is unblocked, at least last I checked.
And foot fetish is a term that had been blocked and then was unblocked.
Right. So yeah, there's a whole host of terms that were previously blocked, which I identified and now are unblocked. I'm not sure we could draw a direct correlation and say that Weibo is opening up or whether or not certain terms are now okay to use and others aren't that we haven't been able to detect. But certainly based on the keyword searches that we're able to perform now, there seems to be an opening up, yeah.
One thing I find interesting is that there are terms that you would think would be supportive of the Chinese state and Chinese nationalism that are blocked. For example, the term medicine patch flag and also the term boycott Japanese goods. So, and these are things that flash up when there's a dispute with Japan over some island chain. So why would the government want to block a term like that?
Yeah. Clearly, as you mentioned, the thermostat, I think that's a great example. Certainly, China wants to further their own interests via the internet. The Chinese government authorities, they feel like the internet is, and social media is potentially of great benefit to them. And as we talked about, Xi Jinping using the social media as an anti-corruption device. And again, they feel that social media could also be used as this sort of lever against foreign issues, on foreign issues. So for instance, this dispute over these islands in the East China Sea with Japan. They're called the Senkaku Islands in Japanese and the Diaoyu Islands in Chinese. And last year, there's a big dispute because the Japanese government tried to purchase these islands outright, and the Chinese government obviously was not pleased with that decision. And netizens were outraged as well on the Chinese government's behalf. They didn't need much prodding to suddenly go up online and they remembered the past history of Japanese colonization of China and the atrocities that took place. So they were very much supportive of the government's stance of no, we can't give in to the Japanese. Unfortunately, it perhaps went too far, and there were street protests. There were not just street protests, but there was rioting in various cities across the country and Japanese.
And that's too hot.
That's too hot.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, you could see that the blocking and unblocking is related to these types of incidents.
And also, there are issues about China's territorial integrity that seem to come up a lot. Tell us about the term snow lion flag.
Yeah, so that's another, the previous one that we mentioned, medicine patch flag, that's an insult for the Chinese, the Japanese government, or Japan, because a medicine patch sort of looks like the Japanese flag, the rising sun. So this is another flag, again, related to, an entity that has conflicts with China. It's in fact, the snow lion flag was one that was popularly flown by Tibet. In the 50s and 60s, I believe. Although it wasn't popularly flown, it was the national emblem of sorts. But it's now gained prominence in recent years because it's been used as a symbol for the Free Tibet or Tibet independence movements. And obviously, Tibet independence is a thorny issue. Tibet is a minority group that's acknowledged and respected by the Chinese government, like other minority groups within China. Unfortunately, they also have to suffer with a lot of discrimination, economically, education-wise, socially. So, it's a very clearly a sensitive topic.
You're a researcher. You're not a prognosticator. So it's unfair of me to ask you this question, but I'll ask you anyway. So we already see that there are people within China who use VPNs, who use other technologies to get around the firewall. Do you see the firewall remaining strong, or do you see it nibbled away at the edges in the years to come?
Yeah, as an optimist, certainly, I would love to be able to say definitively that that due to the development of these amazing tools that we have out there now, that opening up will take place because of the great technology that we can give to netizens in different places around the world. But I think it's not just simply a matter of providing tools. We also have to give the government other reasons, incentives to open up, and certainly economic incentives is a major part of it. And we've seen this most clearly with how they've handled certain things, like, for instance, when they tried to shut down GitHub last year or earlier in the year, there was such an outrage within the software development community within China that China actually backtracked. They tried to shut it down because it was supposedly spreading this sort of anti-censorship software. But because the software developers, which are an important key component of maintaining economic growth in the country, because they have such such a voice on social media, they were able to convince the government to back off from those plans. So I think ensuring that China continues to develop these interconnections with the global economy with the global intellectual sphere within making sure that China's more connected, I think, is just as important as providing these technological tools to netizens.
How can our viewers keep track of your work going forward?
Yeah, I have a blog called blog.weibo.com, which has some of the keywords in the book, so you can take a look at that. And the Citizen Lab, where I work at for now, also produces great work that you could take a peek at. So yeah, I think that's probably the best way to follow me, although I'm also on Twitter at Jason Q Wing.
Are you also on Weibo?
I don't know
or
if I should reveal
it. Well, you don't reveal it.
Okay,
let's keep it under wraps.
Sounds good.
It was really great to meet you. Thanks very much for your time, Jason.
No, thank you, Ryan. It was a pleasure.